Hello and welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show for the last 5 years, during which time I've talked to an enormous range of people involved in integrative medicine for cancer. Practitioners, doctors, oncologists, actually working with people who have cancer, researchers pushing the frontiers of our knowledge of cancer and cancer treatments, people with their own extraordinary tale to tell that can throw light on the broader experience of cancer, and activists working to push forward the agenda for integrative medicine for cancer. Today, I'm speaking to a medical herbalist who has long experience supporting people through cancer treatment. Over the years, I've only occasionally had a medical herbalist on the show, but when I have, the interview has always been popular as herbs are of interest to a lot of people and certainly seem to have a lot to offer. I'm speaking to Hannah Sharman over the internet. Hi, Hannah. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So people who understand the potential of traditional herbal medicine to help people with cancer throughout their treatment, they tend to be very passionate about advocating for their use for this purpose. Lots of others have absolutely no idea. They might actually think it's a ridiculous notion that some simple herbs could play an important role in helping someone with something so serious as cancer. So I wonder if you'd like to start out with what is called an elevator pitch on behalf of herbs. So this is your opportunity. You're in the lift, all right, and you've got this influential senior oncologist in there with you. He's prepared to listen. You've got 30 seconds in the lift with him. What are you going to say?
Wow, no pressure then.
No.
Well, I think the first point I would make is that a lot of people realise that certain mainstream drugs are derived from herbs. So we've got things like aspirin and digoxin that we use in heart failure. But that does actually include some chemotherapeutic drugs as well that we use to treat cancer. So, for example, there's been cristine, which is used to treat certain leukemias and childhood cancers. There's Taxol, which is used to treat breast cancer sometimes, and there's mistletoe injections called Iscador, which are used in some areas to treat prostate cancer. So I don't think we can have it both ways. We can't say, well, herbs are just completely hopeless in cancer treatment and yet make chemotherapy drugs from herbs. And actually in China now, because they've had this long tradition of using mainstream medicine and traditional Chinese medicine, including herbs, next door to each other, if you like, it's now considered negligent in China for a patient to be prescribed mainstream treatments for cancer without being prescribed herbs alongside.
How about that? Things can be so different on the other side of the planet, can't they?
Absolutely.
Okay, that's your pitch. So let's hope he was listening and took note.
I hope so.
So like many of the guests who appear on this show, your interest in and your study of natural or lifestyle medicines, in your case herbs, came about as a result of your own health issues. Would you tell us about this?
Yeah, so when I was very young, I wanted to be a vet. And that's all I wanted to do. I wasn't interested in any other career at all. So I worked very hard at school. And then every evening of the week, I had a different hobby to go to and something else at weekends. And I was always on the go and, you know, quite happy, very active, very into my schoolwork and learning and so on. And then one day when I was 14, my dad picked me up from school in the car. And we stopped at the shops on the way home. And he asked me if I would get out and go to the shop. And I couldn't get out of the car.
Blimey.
And it turned out I had chronic fatigue syndrome, but it had literally come on in the space of 5 minutes. And so it became apparent fairly early on that the doctors weren't interested in or able to help me. And so I was left for a few weeks to see if I'd get better on my own, and I obviously didn't. And my mum and dad very kindly took me to see various other alternative practitioners because there wasn't really any other option for them. So I got taken to a homeopathic doctor in London, and he sat down and listened to me very carefully and took me very seriously, gave me some medicine and a lot of supplements, and I started to get better.
Right.
And then I got to see various other practitioners And slowly over the course of 2 years, I got better and better. At the end of that, I went on a Reiki course with my dad. Mm-hmm. Spent a week learning Reiki, and that saw off the last of it. But during that Reiki course, I learned a lot about the mind-body connection, which I think we're going to talk about a bit later on. And I decided after that experience that that was along the lines of what I wanted to do, and I was off the idea of being a vet. And it just so happened that there was a degree course in Western herbal medicine setting up at the time, and I managed to get onto that one.
Interesting. Did you ever find out what had caused this very sudden onset of chronic fatigue?
I think on some level, I think it sounds odd, but it was meant to be, because my life changed course dramatically as a result of that. And not just mine, but my family as well. So my dad left his job in the police. So he'd been a policeman in London for 25 years. He left that job, retrained as a hypnotherapist because he was so impressed with the hypnotherapy that I'd had, he decided to retrain. And my mum as well, she left her job as a teacher, and they set up a hypnotherapy practice between them. And it was very successful for a number of years. And we can still sort of see how my family's life today tracks back to my experience of being ill when I was 14. But the other way of looking at it was, I was just burnt out. I was just overdoing it, even at the age of 14. Right. It can happen, and it can happen frighteningly fast, actually. People don't realise how quickly they can go from being perfectly or seemingly perfectly healthy to being really quite poorly.
Clearly. Shocking story. Mm. Okay, well, anyway, silver linings there, though, definitely.
Absolutely.
So I think everyone's got to be aware that herbal medicine is a traditional form of healing with a story that goes right back as long as human beings have been trying to make themselves well. Can you give us some sort of potted history of how we got to where we are now with our knowledge of the properties of herbs?
I'll do my best. So okay. I would say as long as there have been people and plants living together, there will be some tradition of those two working in synergy and people using plants for medicine. Mm-hmm. Certainly we can trace it back thousands of years. So the ancient Egyptians used herbs and, you know, likely way before that. And the way we've learned about herbs is through using them and then passing that tradition down through stories and through the generations. Also, we used to watch animals and watch which herbs they would go and eat when they were ill with various different things, particularly the nomadic people. When they moved to a new area, they would watch the animals in that area and look at which plants they were eating and why they were eating them. And then they would deduce from that which herbs they could use. And then we had, obviously, what we would call the wise women. So they were also known as midwives, and a midwife would see you through birth and death and everything in between. And they had a very strong knowledge of herbs, which again was likely passed down through generations of their family. So unfortunately, in the Middle Ages, there was a kind of Holocaust scale culling of the wise women because they were mistaken for witches. So all that knowledge pretty much disappeared. And likewise, any books and anything they had written down, with very few exceptions, disappeared with it. And I don't think we've ever really recovered from that over here in the West, sadly. If you look at other parts of the world where they've had an unbroken tradition for thousands of years, it's a much stronger way of working there than it is here. So herb medicine as it is now is a happy blend of what's left of that tradition and science.
Right.
So I like to think I've got a foot in each camp. But herbalists, by their nature, are a very diverse bunch. So you have some herbalists at the more traditional, folky end of the scale, and some who are more at the very medical, scientific end of the scale. And there's room for everyone. But I love seeing science confirm what we know through our tradition, and that happens quite often, actually.
So this is a recent development, really, that science has turned its attention to looking at these things. I mean, of course, as you pointed out, they've been very interested in looking at them from the point of view of producing drugs, but they have also started to look at them for their own properties more recently. And this is certainly, as you say, it's confirming some of the reasons these things work. But is it actually uncovering new information we didn't know?
It is actually. So a good example is recently with coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
There was some studies done over in Asia looking at ginkgo biloba, mm-hmm. which is the last herb any of us would have thought of for a coronavirus. But they'd already, because they'd obviously been hit by it much sooner than we had over here, found out about what can happen with the blood and how it makes tiny little blood clots, which can make someone very seriously ill. And they worked out that ginkgo was a really good herb for treating those blood clots.
Mm.
So that is the last herb we would ever have thought about over here in the West for treating people with coronavirus. But it's, you know, that's a good example of how it can happen. So more often than not, the science kind of confirms what we already know and explains how herbs work.
Mm-hmm.
But every now and again, it does throw up a little gem like this where it gives us, you know, new ways of using herbs. So it's very interesting. Unfortunately, herbal medicine gets 0.1% of the global research budget,
right,
which is tiny, because herbs can't be patented. So there's no financial gain in most cases to be made from finding out about the medicinal properties of herbs, which is a shame. But despite that, there is more science out there supporting the use of herbs than you might expect. So right. You can have a good trawl through something like the PubMed website. When you have a moment, you'll find quite a lot of good research there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's the story of all natural medicines, unfortunately, is they don't fit into the for-profit model that is the basis of healthcare.
Exactly.
So I'm just kind of interested, you already mentioned about unbroken traditions in herbal medicine elsewhere. And it is a rather different picture, isn't it? Over in the East, like in India with Ayurveda or in China. How does our herbal medicine here kind of relate to that?
So what they all have in common is that they're trying to treat the patient instead of the illness. So they're looking at the whole person, not just the physical aspects of what's going on, but the psychological aspects, the emotional aspects, and often the spiritual side of things as well. So that's what kind of ties it all together.
Hmm.
But that's probably where the similarity ends, really, because the traditions and the systems that they use for understanding what's going on in a person are worlds apart from what we have here in the West. So in Ayurveda, they have the three, what they call the three dosha system, where they will put your constitution into one of the three doshas. And in China, so they have the five element system, where they're looking at how the energetics of a person is influencing their illness. Over here, our tradition is derived from the Middle East. So it came from the Middle East and across Europe via, you know, ancient Greece. And ended up over here in Western Europe. So that was very much based around astrology and looking at energetics. So there were four humours that we used to use. So the Ayurvedic had three doshas and the Chinese have five elements and we had the four humours. And that's how we understood the constitution of the person and which herbs would be suitable for them. Mm. Now, we don't even use that so much. So some herbal medicine colleges teach that in quite a lot of detail. I certainly wasn't taught that, so I had to kind of teach myself, really, since I've qualified. It's very difficult to fully understand your craft if you don't have an energetic tradition of some kind to hang it on. Mm. I've had a little look at traditional Chinese medicine and I can't even begin to get my head around it.
Right.
It's like talking two completely different languages. So there are a few herbalists who are kind of bilingual and can do a bit of Chinese and a bit of Western, but I can't do it personally. It doesn't make sense to me. So I stick fairly and squarely in the Western tradition over here.
Right. So the basis on which the prescribing is happening is very different. Obviously, that's what, when you say different language, that's what you really mean, is that the kind of criteria for decision making is very different. Am I right in that?
Yeah, so it's the system, the framework that they use is very different in Asia to the one we have over here.
Yeah. So given that, though, is there any crossover in the actual herbs that are used?
Well, there is now, because the world's a very small place. So I've got a lot of herbs in my dispensary here that I would find within a mile or two of my house. But I've also got a few from North America, quite a few from Asia, even one or two from Australia. Surprisingly, not many from Africa. We were having this discussion the other day, and we don't seem to have many African herbs in our dispensaries, and we're not quite sure why that is. So it's something to look at. But yeah, because we herbs are like everything else. They come and go in fashion.
Yes.
So there are a lot of herbs that we would have used here probably even like 25, 30 years ago when I was training that have gone out of popularity now. So I'm on a bit of a mission to revive those a little bit.
Okay. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? With in a way, there's this wealth of knowledge around the planet. There's this wealth of herbs. I mean, immense number of potentially useful herbs out there. But it's a little bit siloed, really, in a way, if you imagine that the probably herbal medicine is pretty big in Africa, but you don't use any. The potential is great if you really bring them together.
I don't know why Africa seems to have been left out. There's a distinct lack of herbs from there, but we'll go on a mission to bring some over, I think, and start learning about them.
Good. So a little point I'd like to clarify. You describe yourself as a medical herbalist, and I believe this particular title indicates a particular program of training. Do you want to just make clear what the difference between a herbalist and a medical herbalist is?
So a medical herbalist, in the true sense of the word, has some kind of formal medical training, usually to degree level or equivalent. Right. So I trained for 4 years at Middlesex University, and during that time, I learned about a lot of the same things that a trainee doctor would learn. Mm-hmm. But I also learned my herbal materia medica and my therapeutics, and we did 200-hour clinical training at a dedicated clinic, which was in the grounds of Whittington Hospital in North London. So that's the true definition of a medical herbalist. A herbalist can train, do an online course or, a one-day workshop and still call themselves a herbalist. It's just worth bearing in mind that even medical herbalist is not a protected title.
All right.
So you could go out, set up a herbal medicine practice, call yourself a medical herbalist, and you wouldn't be breaking any laws at all. Which is a shame. It's a kind of a long and complicated story. But basically, we campaigned for about 25 years to be state regulated and have a protected title in the same way that doctors, midwives, physiotherapists, nurses, and so on would have. So back in 2011, the government finally agreed that we could have that as of April 2012. So we were very excited. We waited for April 2012 to come, and it came, and nothing. There was no word. There was no communication. There was nothing, no sign of it at all. So we chased it, and the government came back to us and said that they were not going to go ahead and regulate us because our safety record was so good that they couldn't justify the cost. So we remain unregulated. What I would say is if you're thinking of going to work with a medical herbalist, make sure you vet them thoroughly, because I have heard one or two horror stories, not from properly trained medical herbalists, but people who thought they were working with someone qualified and they weren't, and they ended up in serious trouble. It doesn't happen often, but you need to be very thorough with your checks if you're thinking of working with a medical herbalist.
Okay, so this is interesting. So what do people check for? And particularly if there's somebody with cancer, what are they looking for?
So what I would suggest is that they check out that person's training and ask to see their degree certificate. Mm-hmm. That they ask about any ongoing training they've done since they qualified. Also, I would recommend that they choose someone who is the member of a governing body, because if there's ever any cause for complaint, that governing body will be able to help you. So I belong to the National Institute of Medical Herbalists, which is the largest and oldest of the governing bodies of Western medical herbalists. And they have very strict entry criteria. They have strict CPD criteria. We have a code of ethics that we have to abide by. We have to have insurance. And if there's ever any complaint, the council deal with it. Good. So you've got some extra security there if you find someone who's member of a governing body. But also, don't take their word for it. Go onto that governing body's website and do a search on their name to make sure that they are still a valid member, because, you know, you just don't know with people. They might say they're a member and they're not, or they've let their membership lapse, and then you don't have that extra protection.
Mm-hmm. All right. So there, even if there isn't government recognition, there is self-regulation, which is effective.
Yes.
Yeah, good. All right, that's great. So come on, we now need to talk about cancer. This is a show about cancer. Mm-hmm. And you're somebody who likes to help people with cancer, so that's great. So as with many approaches that can be integrated into a programme of treatment, I'm guessing that herbal medicine has a role to play in supporting well-being and recovery generally, but also in managing the challenge of the many side effects of conventional treatments. Would you start out by telling us what herbal medicine has to offer in the realm of overall health and well-being and supporting recovery?
So I think, first of all, we need to distinguish the difference between going to Holland and Barrett, picking something off the shelf that you read somewhere on a website might help you with your cancer, mm-hmm. and working with a medical herbalist. Because with the herbalist, it's not just about the herbs that you're taking. It's the whole package. It's the moral support you're getting. It's the guidance on your diet and lifestyle. It's the advocacy, because we do a lot of that as well now. So if you need someone to fight your corner for any reason, then we take on that role too. Right. Certainly, my role has changed, not just in terms of supporting people with cancer, but in general, since I qualified, because, you know, the charities are under so much pressure that they can't always provide the services that they'd like to. The NHS is in a similar position, so doctors have much less time now. They can't offer the care to the level that they want to either. So, you know, unfortunately, the people who suffer are the patients. Hmm. So my role has now got much bigger, because I'm starting to fill in those gaps. In terms of what we can do specifically, we don't influence a patient's decision either way. So by the time they come to a medical herbalist, they're usually on some kind of treatment path with regards to their cancer, and our role is to support them whatever decision they make with regards to that. Right. So usually people will be on something like chemotherapy or having surgery and so on, in which case we can use the herbs to support them through that process and make it more bearable for them. Because as you know, it can take quite a big toll on people, not just physically, but emotionally. It's very difficult as well, and psychologically, particularly where people don't feel able to speak openly in front of their family, even if their family are not coping with the situation very well, then they have that way of offloading, if you like, to a medical herbalist without any fear of being judged or anything like that. So we work on all levels. I would say that herbal medicine ideally would need to be used in a wider context. So there's no point, for example, taking herbs if your diet is terrible and you're up all night because you're not going to sleep and so on. It needs to be part of a bigger thing. But yes, so there's lots of different ways. All the medicine is tailored to the person. So what we're doing is looking at you as a whole person and then working with you in terms of what your priorities are. So let's just say, for example, your stress levels were absolutely through the roof. Well, that's not a good thing on any level, is it? Because you're not going to be sleeping properly. You're probably not going to be eating properly. You're pumping out tons of stress hormones. You might be eating, you know, loads of sugar, which is in turn going to feed you cancer. And if we can just start to bring those stress levels down, that is already making you a more difficult place for cancer to live. So it's really a question of tailoring the medicine to the person.
Right. Okay. So in terms of the ways in which you can support well-being, though, that's one you've described there, helping people with stress levels. Obviously, as you said, you want to see this as part of a broader package, not just herbal medicines on their own in amongst a horrendous lifestyle. But given, let's say, that the person is prepared to look more broadly, what would be the specific areas in which herbs are particularly useful with other kinds of problems such as stress?
Yeah, so I don't know many cancer patients who aren't totally stressed out by their situation.
Right.
So we can use herbs called adaptogens, which help the body out of its stress response, regardless of what's going on. So stress will impact different people in different ways. So some people, for example, might get migraines with stress. Some people might get digestive problems. Some people find their skin breaks out. So we're, again, looking at how the stress is affecting that person and what we can do to buffer that.
Right.
So adaptogens have a kind of general effect on the whole body. You can give someone an adaptogen and they'll usually come back and say, I feel better, but I can't quite put my finger on how.
Right.
And that's because it's working on the whole body at the same time. So adaptogens like goji berry, for example, will take you out of your stress response, reduce your stress hormones down, but also work on your liver at the same time. And goji berry is very useful for increasing white blood cell count when someone's going through rounds of chemotherapy, because often that will reduce the white blood cell count. And if it reduces to a point where it becomes dangerous for them to continue on their chemotherapy, then they have to stop it.
Right.
So there's one example of where we can use a herb to keep the blood cell count where it should be in order for them to continue their treatment through to the final cycle.
Hmm. But with other benefits as well. So it's has a broad effect.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then with adaptogens, we often use them alongside a different class of herb, which we call nervines. Mm-hmm. And nervines have a more direct effect upon the nervous system. So you might have heard about, for example, St. John's wort, probably not my first choice in cancer because of the concerns over interfering with other drugs. But that's one example of one that you might have heard of. But other nervines we have would include things like valerian, rose, chamomile. You know, a lot of nervines are ones you can get very easily in the shops or in your local cafe. Mm-hmm. So they work hand in hand with the nervines. And then we can give you other herbs which make you a more difficult place for cancer to live, is probably the easiest way of putting it.
Okay. So what would you mean by that?
So herbs that can influence the immune system in a way that makes it easier for the immune system to recognise and kick out any cancer cells. And there is a lot of science around this. If you want to go and do a search on something like PubMed, you'll find that there's a lot of good research around this. So alliums, you know, the allium family, onions and garlic and chives and leeks. Mm-hmm. That's one example where they've shown to make it harder for cancer to reproduce in various different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't think, would you, that just eating more onions in your diet or garlic is going to make a big difference. But there, you know, there is the science there to support that. So another one is medicinal mushrooms. So they've been used in Asia now for well over 2,000 years. And we're only just now starting to cotton on to them in Western herbal medicine. So probably in the last 5 years or so, they've become much more popular amongst Western medical herbalists. And again, they contain a specific kind of polysaccharide called beta-glucans. And you also get beta-glucans in oats as well. And they are what we call immunomodulators, so that they change the way the immune system works in a way that makes it easier for them to recognize cancer cells and destroy them. So there's lots of different options with herbal medicine.
There are. Yes, it's interesting that you don't necessarily think of mushroom products as being within the remit of a herbalist, but they are now, of course. And I think they're extraordinary things, mushrooms. I mean, you know how things come and go in fashion, like you said? Well, as far as I'm concerned, that you know, the case for mushrooms was there when I started YesterLife 15 years ago, and it's still there just as strongly, or actually more strongly than ever now. There's so many benefits to people with cancer that can come from medicinal mushrooms. It's just like they should not be ignored.
No, we shouldn't. I mean, I've had a patient recently who had, he was quite elderly and he had bladder cancer. And for various reasons, he had other health issues, which meant that his surgery had to be delayed. So he was having the herbs for those other health issues. And we were giving him medicinal mushrooms, and the the doctors, the oncologists that he was working with were quite surprised to find that all the time he was having it, the cancer didn't shrink, but it didn't grow either. And they were expecting it to have grown significantly right. by the time he got in for surgery. So he was obviously very pleased with that. Mm. And obviously at the moment with people unable to get certain kinds of cancer treatment, or if they, I've got another gentleman who's just had the news that he may have prostate cancer right before lockdown. So that put a stop to any further investigations in hospital. He's just been left on his own at home, you know, no family, no friends to support him, wondering whether or not he's got prostate cancer, which is an awful situation to be in. But we've got him on the mushrooms and we've got him on other herbs as well. Because there's always something you can do with herbal medicine. That's what I love about it most. You're never helpless and hopeless. Mm. Regardless of what your situation is, there's always something you can do. And he feels a lot better as well for knowing that he's doing something proactive to help himself.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, that's a very good story, yeah. Well, I must say, you know, when it comes to mushrooms, and this is obviously true of other things as well, but the way you described the accusations of negligence if you didn't use these things alongside conventional treatment, I feel exactly that way about it. I think in this country we are negligent to overlook these cheap, effective, natural products.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there are a handful of enlightened oncologists out there who are willing to work alongside medical herbalists. Mm-hmm. There are medical herbalists who treat cancer as their primary thing, usually because they've been through a cancer journey themselves, and they specialise in treating that, or they have a special interest in that. And they tend to strike up a very strong relationship with their local oncologists, and find it much easier to work with them than your than sort of non-specialist herbalists. Mm. But so there are a few out there who are cottoning onto this now.
Oh, good.
I think doctors in general are becoming more open to herbal medicine. I've certainly noticed a big change in the last few years.
Good.
And I get a lot of patients too. So there is hope. There's a lot of doctors retraining to be medical herbalists. Mm. Our president, Nim, at the moment is a former GP. So things are changing, thankfully.
Yeah, well, always glad to hear reports of that. So look, can we have a look at the ways in which herbs can help manage the side effects of common conventional treatments like chemotherapy, radiotherapy, hormone therapy, things that a lot of people are having that create a lot of problems?
Yeah, okay. So obviously the first priority for us as medical herbalists is not to do any harm and not to give anything that's likely to interfere with that treatment.
Right.
So as far as chemotherapy goes, it's so powerful that there's very little. In fact, I can't really think of any herbs that are going to come anywhere close to touching the chemotherapy. We still have to bear in mind that if, God forbid, the chemotherapy treatment were to fail and there was going to be someone to blame for that, we wouldn't want to be in the firing line. And it's a horrible way to have to think. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, this is the world we live in these days. So we always have that at the back of our minds as well. Mm-hmm. Really, it's a question of, like I said, supporting the person through that treatment. So as an example, I've got a friend at the moment whose three-year-old daughter is in hospital having treatment for leukemia. The main problem that she was most distressed by was that the chemo was giving her a really sore bottom. Mm-hmm. And I saw the photo and it was raw. I've never seen anything like it. So I just did her some cream for that. And within days, she was much more comfortable and it was healing up really nicely. So it's a really small thing, but it makes a really big difference, not just to that little girl, but to her family as well, because they didn't have the distress of having to see all, you know, her in all that pain.
Right.
I'm feeling unable to do anything about it.
Right.
We also look at other things we can do as well. So besides the herbal treatment with fasting, I don't know whether you know about the role of fasting with chemotherapy.
Yes, we looked into it for a bit.
Yeah, so in North America, they realised quite a while back that outcomes of chemotherapy treatment were often much better if the patient fasted either side of the dose. And there's various different ways in which that works, but this is not mainstream advice in the NHS. You won't ever find a cancer patient being told by their nurse or their oncologist to fast either side of the treatment. But people seem to tolerate chemo much better very often, and it works much more effectively when they fast either side. That is not a particularly easy process. It's not pleasant, and it's not very easy thing to do. So again, that person will often need quite a bit of moral support and some guidance on exactly how to do it. So there are options there. And like I said before, we can do things like protect the liver a little bit against liver and kidneys and other internal organs against damage from chemotherapy. It's really a question of looking at the individual drug, looking at the effect it's going to have on the body and the likely side effects. And then again, we tailor the medicine accordingly.
Right.
But there are actually some herbs that will potentiate chemotherapy and make it work better as well.
Mm.
In terms of radiation therapy, again, it depends on how it's affecting the person. But for radiation burn, we can use things topically. So, you know, things like aloe vera gel is very useful on the skin for radiation burn. But there are also herbs that we can give that are very potent in antioxidants that will also help that person to cope with their radiotherapy. Hormone therapy is a bit of a minefield. So there are certain herbs that we wouldn't be able to use with that. And there's also a lot of misunderstanding around herbs. This is another problem that I've encountered recently. So I had an elderly gentleman who had prostate cancer that was being treated with hormones. And at the same time, he had diverticulitis. But the diverticulitis was so bad that it was actually much more dangerous for him than the cancer was at the point he came to see me. So one of the best herbs for diverticulitis is Mexican wild yam, Dioscorea. So I did a lot of work on this, and I checked and checked and checked again to make sure that it was safe to give him. I asked everyone I could think of. We all agreed that it was safe. The problem was that Mexican wild yam is used to make HRT. So it contains a thing called diastenin, which is used to make progesterone creams. And it has to be done in a lab because the human body can't do it itself. So there's no way that the human body can make progesterone from this herb. It has to be done in a lab. But nonetheless, his wife read off the bottle what the contents of the bottle were, got onto Google, realized that Mexican wild yam is used to make HRT, spoke to the oncology nurse, and the oncology nurse told him to stop taking his herb straight away.
Right. A case of a little knowledge.
And we come up against these kinds of problems quite often. Yeah, you have to do a bit of negotiating and a bit of educating as well sometimes.
Right.
How
about helping with kind of some of the very general things that a lot of people suffer from, like, say, fatigue with cancer treatments?
Yeah, again, we can help with that. So we look into why that person has the fatigue. Often it is the side effect of the treatment itself, but also are they stressing out to the point where they're not sleeping at night? Because if we can just nail the sleep aspect of it, that alone goes quite a long way towards helping. So it's a question of looking deeply at what exactly is going on and what we can do about it. We have lots of options with this.
Right. Good. And how about things like neuropathy? You know, a lot of people suffer from nerve damage in their fingers and toes and things from chemotherapy.
So again, we can give herbs internally for that, but we can also use topical herbs. So things like oils and creams that you can rub on that will start to work on the neuropathy. Also, what we can do is try and get the medicine as close to where it's needed as possible. So if someone has got, say, for example, cervical cancer, we could use pessaries. We could use suppositories for prostate cancer. We can use inhalations for lung cancer. So there's a way of getting the medicine very close to where it needs to be.
Right. Okay, interesting. And I mean, something that's a bit physical in the way of, you know, people suffering from lymphedema, it's because they've had some lymph nodes removed, they've gone. Obviously, you can't change that. But can you do anything to help their situation?
Yeah, so lymphatic drainage massage would usually be part of their treatment anyway from the hospital. But we can use herbs like, I would be thinking of something like cleavers, which is a common herb that we see in the spring all over the UK. That is a brilliant lymphatic herb, and I've never known anything like it for reducing, you know, the water retention that you get when your lymphatics are under pressure. So there's always options there as well.
Well, it's great. It does sound like there's something on hand for a lot of the things that people suffer from. So very interesting. Okay, well, look, you mentioned at the beginning about being passionate about the part of the mind and the world of feelings in recovering your health and well-being. Well, I'd agree with you there. We are at Yes to Life as well. But would you explain why you think this is the case and expand a bit more on the ways in which you would seek to address this?
So I was first introduced to this idea back when I was 15, 16, and I did that Reiki course. And my Reiki master was Australian, and she'd flown all over the world training herself as a Reiki master. It took her 7 years to train, and her knowledge was phenomenal. But she always maintained that there's much more to illness than the physical. There's always a psycho-emotional aspect to it as well. And she said that every illness and injury is triggered by the subconscious mind, which kind of kept a bit of an open mind on to begin with. And then I thought about my own situation and realized that I pushed myself far too hard. And when I looked into why, it was because I was looking for approval from parents that they were never able to give because they had their own issues.
Right.
Once I realized that and letting go, I lost the need for the chronic fatigue syndrome. I lost the need to push myself that hard to the point where my body had to put its own brakes on. And I've never had it back since. So I've still remained very active and very ambitious and very hardworking, but I've lost that need to kind of put a stop on myself when I push things too far. So what we find very often with the types of person who get cancer is that they tend to be what she would call a very nice person. And by that, I mean, they tend to put other people's needs above their own. If they're annoyed or upset, they tend not to vocalize that. They will internalize it. They tend to have a problem with boundaries so that they get put upon, you know, unwittingly by people around them. They don't like to say no. And my Reiki master always used to say that there was often some suppressed anger there. Mm-hmm. So if you're not emotionally literate and you're not vocalizing your anger or dealing with it physically, it will literally eat away at you in the form of cancer. And the more I've worked with people over the years, I've been a medical herbalist now for 21 years, I'm absolutely convinced that this is the case. Mm. So I had a cancer patient a few years back who was the same age as me, and very sadly, she'd had multiple bereavements in the few years before. So she'd lost 4 close members of her family.
Wow.
And I sat and I listened to her story. She'd never smoked. She wasn't a drinker. She ate very well. She did look after herself on the physical level. But in metaphysical terms, as I was taught it, the lungs are where we hold on to grief. So I thought, there's an obvious connection there between, you know, the multiple bereavements and the grief and the cancer. But I didn't mention this to her. And she sat in the appointment with me and she said, I feel like I've been grieving my whole life. Mm. And then we talked about it some more, and she was so bereft by what had happened that she'd actually said to me that she didn't want to be alive anymore. She wanted to go and join these people who had gone before her,
right.
Which sounds really morbid, but you've got to look at this in the wider context that, you know, I think most people in her situation would feel the same. And that is actually what happened in the end. So we did our best and, you know, we looked at other ways of looking at it. But the decision was made that it was time for her to go. Mm. And I had similar myself last year. I had an abnormal smear test result, but it was as abnormal as abnormal could be without it actually being cancer. So it was enough to give me a bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah.
And it was a total shock because that's never happened before.
Right.
And I, you know, I eat pretty well. I'm pretty happy. You know, I had no major things going on in my life. But, you know, I went into hospital to have this procedure done, and it was shocking. It was very widespread damage. And, you know, you could see from the way the doctors and the nurses were looking at each other that it really wasn't good. So after that, I came home and I had a bit of a think about what had driven me to that point where I'd almost given myself cancer. And the cervix is to do with childbearing and intimate relationships and close family. So I thought, okay, well, that's the first place to start looking. And I realized that actually, you know, my son was born nearly 6 years ago, and he was born with a genetic condition called PKU, which, as genetic conditions go, is probably about the best one to have. But from my point of view, it means that we have to control his diet very, very strictly. Hmm. So it's all managed by diet. Which, you know, most of that's fallen to me to do because I'm his mum. And it takes about an extra 20 hours a week to deal with.
Right.
On top of that, so it's 20 hours a week that I couldn't spend working or spending with the family or doing any of the other stuff that I'd like to be doing. So I don't begrudge him this at all. It's just how things are. But what we hadn't done is dealt with it properly. So other PKU families we knew with children of a similar age, as soon as they realized that situation was, you know, not going to be going away, they did things like they moved house or they extended their kitchen or they did whatever they needed to do to make life very, very easy for themselves. And for various reasons, we didn't do that. So this had gone on for 5 years and, you know, we didn't have a dishwasher, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is a big deal when you're doing all this extra catering and then washing up on top. And we just didn't see each other. You know, I didn't see my partner. We didn't really have any relationship anymore because one or other of us was constantly cooking or washing up. Mm. And because my son was getting bigger and he was eating more, so we needed to order more food. We couldn't store it. It was piling up on the kitchen floor. And, you know, various other reasons, I began to really hate and resent where I was living.
Right.
And I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And I think it was just that frustration that led me to that situation. So within 6 months, we moved house. You know, we're now in a house twice the size of the old one, in exactly the kind of place that we've always wanted to live. And we're really happy.
Right.
So I think sometimes you have to do something drastic, particularly if you find yourself in that sort of situation. You've got to do a lot of soul searching and try and figure out, you know, what the message is there, if you like. Right. And for me, that was it. So you've always got to look at it on that level, because I think if you don't get the message, you're risking it happening again, and you don't want to go there, really, do you?
You don't. What an interesting story. Thank you. So look, we're about out of time. I wanted to finish up today in the spirit that we began. Many in the arena of integrative medicine for cancer, including us at Yes to Life, advise building a team to support you through cancer. I'm going to give you another 30-second opportunity in the lift, but this time you're going to be with someone who's recently been diagnosed with cancer, and I'd like to know what you'd have to say to them to convince them to get a herbalist as a key player in their team.
I think the main thing there is that if you work with a herbalist, you feel much more in control of your situation. It's much more empowering, as well as giving you the herbs that will help you to deal with whatever your chosen treatment is. It can help you to make your body a harder place for cancer to live. But you've also got the control over whether you need help with your sleep or your stress or any of your other individual symptoms, but you've got that moral support as well. You've got someone there who is always looking out for you, who you can talk to anytime, and you're not going to be judged, you're not going to have any trouble. You can, you know, offload onto a medical herbalist in a way that you can't offload onto your family or even sometimes your doctor. And there is no way I would consider going along a cancer journey without a herbalist in my corner. So, you know, most of the herbalists I know, if they've had cancer themselves, have gone down the mainstream route and had the chemo or the surgery or whatever they've had to do. But I've never come across a single herbalist who hasn't used herbs.
No, that makes sense.
Because it's a total no-brainer. You've got to integrate other stuff in, and herbs are key to that.
Well, it's certainly, from everything you've said today, they do sound like a huge resource. There seems to be something for everything in the bag there. So fantastic to talk to you. Thanks so much, Hannah. Really interesting. And I hope our listeners enjoyed that as well.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, Hannah's elevator pitch certainly makes a convincing case for considering a medical herbalist as a contender for your team to help you through cancer. I want to encourage you to take a look at the new searchable radio show page on the Yes to Life website. If you go to yestolife.org.uk and scroll down the home page, there you can click the link to the Yes to Life show page, which you'll find has the current show and most of the past 5 years worth of shows listed, but also allows you to search by subject, for example cannabis, by guest, for example Professor Robert Thomas, or simply by using a keyword such as prostate to quickly find the topics or people that you are interested in. This feature makes the enormous wealth of information in the back catalogue hugely more accessible. Thanks for joining me on the show today. Please make a note to listen to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio again next week. Goodbye. Thank you.